all of this noise comes at people, the signal is low. The skills for pulling the signal out of that noise are underdeveloped, not just by K through 12 schooling, but by the undergraduate programs that people are taught. This is what you need to like function in the real world. They add nothing to it, like that article that you link on your website states.
Yeah.
So they still have this need to at least feel like they've obtained the signal from all that noise. So they go to people who claim that they've obtained the signal through the noise, or that they are the signal. And they get a kind of social reinforcement and support for not thinking for themselves. And we see these echo chambers with walls that get 20 feet higher every week. I don't see anything happening that could produce a unification like people felt, say, after 9/11. I don't think a day like that is ever coming back. And at least what's partially responsible for that is the autopilot approach to this information acquisition, where people know they want to feel like they're capable of understanding what's going on, but deep down they don't feel like that. They've been schooled to believe that their whole lives. And now the reinforcements for that schooling come in these people who say, come with me, don't think for yourself, this is the way it is. And it affects all different, you know, political, ideological, philosophical stripes that people might be.
Yeah, my favorite metaphor of that comes from a Powderina book, and it's in the first chapter. He gives this metaphor of people listening to the news and recording on their personal cassette tape what they will say to people after. So you just like, you get the input and you spit it right back. And because of that, your thoughts are no different from anyone else. The implication of this is that you are disposable, you're expendable. Because you're just thinking like everyone else. If you're not contributing something different, if you're not asking even a question, then you're contributing to a narrative that's already been said over and over again. So what's your value? And no one wants to feel that way. And yet that's what we've been doing to ourselves.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Everybody's wasting time. Everybody's
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Thursday, April 2nd, and despite that gloomy intro, even though we are going to turn it around, we are going to squeeze some positivity out of it, I thought it was time for, by and large, a change of pace, new topics, and in order to be able to do that, I had to go back to something that I recorded weeks and weeks ago with a listener named Stacy Hill, and Stacy has a story about college, about career, about the work she does today, and the view that that has given her of the current state, even though the current state of education when we recorded this is not the current state of education today. But you are actually, in our conversation, as the intro hinted, you're going to find some tie-ins to the new condition that has developed for compulsory schooling and higher education over the last month. And this show actually winds up being very future-oriented. So I remember that I was sitting on it. I was looking for an opportune time to release this. I woke up this morning and I said, why not today? I expect that Stacy and I will have another conversation at some time in the future. I think she's a great resource for what we do here. And as the title suggests, we round out the conversation. After I let Stacy tell her very interesting story, we round out the conversation looking at perhaps the most detailed qualitative and largest quantitative study on student attitudes towards schooling, I think, that at least as far as I can find, ever conducted. So those are the elements of this conversation. Stacy is a relatively new listener. She is also attending the Ideas into Action Virtual Summit, which hopefully by the middle of this month will launch in its new form. There is going to be a weekly discussion group going one presentation at a time. I thought that 2-hour blocks once a week over the next few months, and maybe even beyond that, if people want to continue, would be manageable given the current situation and the other demands on people's time and attention. So that's what we're doing. I'm hoping to start that the second week of April. Like I said in the last show, there's a few variables that leave that not 100% certain, but that is my goal. And if you want to come hang out with us every week, it is not too late. You can go to sspuniversity.com/ideas into action. And if you don't want to pay the listed price, just email me, brett@schoolsucksproject.com. And I have 12 ways, as a matter of fact, that you can get 30% off that price. And it only takes one. So that's it. sspuniversity.com/ideas into action. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I will talk to you again next week. There's a new episode of In Pursuit of Utopia in the works. We recorded that earlier this week. And also, if you are a patron or an AV Club member, be on the lookout for a group conversation that I recorded on Tuesday, just about the current state of affairs, personal and on the larger scale regarding this whole situation. It will be cleverly titled because I'm being careful about like putting buzzwords in titles right now out of concerns about censorship. But it's a really interesting conversation. It was led by Danny McCarthy and myself. It also includes Richard Grove, and it's definitely worth listening to, even though at this point it's a couple days old. But it will certainly be out tomorrow. All right, everybody, that is it. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you are doing well, and we'll have lots of new stuff coming in the very near future. Take care. We really have like a typical listener, but I was when I looked at your credentials and what you were doing, I was really happy that you were listening, but I was also like, I wonder how Stacy found the show. So can you tell me a little bit about that just for my own interest?
Sure, yeah. I can definitely tell you that. So I have a few friends who are devout listeners of Dave Smith, and these friends of mine told me about the episode that you did with him, knowing that I'm an educator and that I'm really interested in schooling. They were like, you should listen to this podcast, School Sucks. And that's how I found you.
So this is all like super recent.
Very recent, like within the past few months.
Oh my goodness. There's still so much for you to discover.
Oh, for sure.
It's great to have you in the audience now, and I'm glad to know the Dave Smith outreach is working out so well. But I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your background. Your friends directed you to this interview because you are an educator. You spent a lot of time being educated prior to this, and you actually recently just left a PhD program, you told me, at Yale in chemistry. But when we were setting up the show, you mentioned to me, your quote was, I've done way too much school, right? So it wasn't like not enough school, just the right amount of school. Your, subjective statement was way too much. So I wanted to start by talking about why you say way too much.
Sure. I guess your listeners should know that I'm someone who is very well suited for school.
Yeah.
So I was like really good at sitting in my seat and being talked at and learning whatever a teacher wanted me to learn. But I've done way too much school because I feel like I've had this really ambling path. I started at the University of Southern California, ended up there just because I was, you know, looking to go to college and realized very quickly that it's easy to pour $50,000 down the drain.
Yes.
I was getting better grades, not going to class and reading on my own and doing my own studying and going out on the weekends. And then I went to another college. I went to a small liberal arts college in Vermont. I went to Middlebury. And then I went to St. John's College in Annapolis. I studied chemistry at Middlebury and I was like, oh, I totally missed the liberal arts experience. So I went to St. John's to get that. And then was like, I still don't really know what I want to do. None of the job descriptions I was reading spoke to me. So I was like, I'll keep going to school. Like, I'm good at this. They'll pay me. My loans will be in deferment. and I'll get more letters. And mm-hmm. everyone's telling me that more letters is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
I said too much.
Well, I understand for like certain career paths. Yeah. Letters are great. But when you started undergrad, what did you envision yourself doing by the time you were, say, 25?
Yeah. Well, I definitely was never asked that question. Right. But I think the closest answer I could give is I wanted to be a pharmacist, which makes no sense to me in retrospect. The only reason why I came up with that job description is because I liked chemistry and I didn't want to be a doctor. So I was like, okay, pharmacist is the next best thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it didn't speak to who I was or what I cared about. I've always cared about school. And so what I should have been doing all this time is been an educator and been in education. And that's what I'm finally doing now.
Yeah. And more on your own or for more innovative operations than traditional teaching in a high school or even in most colleges, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that on the show today. So you went to undergrad for pharmacy.
I went to undergrad for chemistry.
Chemistry.
Like, maybe I'll be a pharmacist.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we're obviously different ages, but I remember the process of trying to cram my identity and my interests into some kind of job that was available as if that was the only way to do it, right? Like, mm-hmm. This is who you are. This is what you like. This is what you care about. This is kind of like the intersection of your talents and your interests. Here's six things in the world that you can do, right? No, I feel often very optimistic about all of the options that young people have today that I, you know, just I was 10 years too early to realize the possibilities of a lot of these things. And I, you know, actually wound up in education, too, just because I liked like presentation of knowledge with like a flair of entertainment. You know, like yeah. That was I liked that my whole life. But then having a college professor who was like that, I was like, this is it. This is the thing. You know, if these other things aren't going to work out. So, yeah, I totally get that story. I actually want to go back to the St. John's part, right?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that.
You mentioned this right on the front page of your website, which everybody has linked in the show notes if you want to learn more about Stacey. This was your second master's degree?
My first master's degree.
Oh, this is your first master's degree. Okay.
Yeah.
So you said St. John's in Annapolis. You link to this article called The Most Forward-Thinking Future-Proof College in America Teaches Every Student the Exact Same Thing. So, you know, I saw that was a hyperlink, that text, so I clicked on it. And I just want to share with the people in the audience the first couple short paragraphs. A recent Pew Research Center survey of 1,408 technology and education professionals suggested that the most valuable skills in the future will be those that machines can't yet easily replicate, like creativity, critical thinking, emotional intelligence, adaptability, and collaboration. In short, people need to learn how to learn, because the only hedge against a fast-changing world is the ability to think, adapt, and collaborate well. But many American college students may not be learning them at all. In the 2011 book, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, Richard Arum and Jarep Roxa chronicled how few American students really improved cognitively and learned to learn during their undergraduate education. So the article goes on to talk about what is literally called the program at St. Yep. John's. And I just want to turn it over to you to tell us as much about it as you can. Because, you know, when people think, like when I was going to college and I heard about people studying liberal arts, it was kind of understood that it like a not a very competitive school. Studying liberal arts is basically like getting a degree in I went to college. Right.
Yeah.
And there's a lack of appreciation for what the liberal arts actually are. People, I never understood it through any of the 4 years that I was in an undergraduate program. So let's talk about the program, a little bit more about why you did it, and ultimately what you got out of it.
Sure. Yeah. So St. John's is a great books college. So what that means is their entire curriculum is based in the primary texts of the Western canon or Western thought. So this means, practically speaking, if you go there for undergrad, your freshman year, you're going to be learning and reading only things written, say, in ancient Greek and Roman times. So you're reading Plato, you're reading Aristotle, you're reading Ptolemy, who thought the earth was at the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You're reading Euclid, who is like the father of the geometry you learn in eighth grade or ninth grade. And then sophomore year, that turns into reading the medieval literature like St. Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, other thinkers of that time. The Bible is a huge part of that literature. And then junior year, you turn to learning calculus from Newton's Principia and Leibniz, the two founders of calculus. Mm-hmm. So you read the always primary texts, always primary sources. And by senior year, you're reading Einstein, you're reading Darwin, you're reading Wittgenstein, you're reading Hegel and Heidegger and all these thinkers that have shaped the way we think and act in society. And so I did their master's program, which people joke is St. John's Light, because you cram all of that into about a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's insane. And some, you know, you have to cut things out because of that. But I think the graduate program is so, it's so enriching because we're not undergrads anymore. So I was in class reading Tocqueville's Democracy in America with someone who is 75 years old, with someone who is a homemaker, with someone who worked in finance, with someone who is a politician in Washington, with, you know, me, who's just straight out of undergrad. So that diversity of experience when you're reading these books that speak to the human condition is so valuable just for like leading a life that you want to live and understanding these hard texts. Practically speaking, St. John's asks you to read something that's really difficult, that's not within your expertise, come to class and be able to either articulate what you learned or articulate what you don't understand. And those are some of the hardest skills that you have, hardest skills to develop. And it's so much easier when you have a group of people who are around you who are interested in those same things and developing those same skills.
Let's talk a little bit about the format for that and the environment, right? So you're assigned these readings. You bring a problem into basically a discussion. That's how it works?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So every class begins with an opening question, which is presented by the professor. We call them tutors. We call them tutors because they are no more expert on this material than we are. These are really hard books and they're accessible to everyone.
Right.
So my most memorable opening question was when we were reading the Bible. I grew up pretty, I'm a Jew. My mom is a Jew from New York. Like, we're kind of atheist Jews. I didn't read the Bible growing up. And the opening question was, we had just read Genesis. Why did Eve do it? Why did she eat the apple? And I was like, what kind of question is like, who asks that? And then we spoke about that question for 2 hours, and we had to dive into just like, you know, the first few pages of Genesis. And there are people in that class who, you know, had strong religious backgrounds who felt very strongly about their religious interpretation of Genesis and what it means. People are sitting around a table with just their books open, asking, okay, so why did Eve take a bite of the apple? Well, does this come from an emotional standpoint? Was she really tricked by the snake? People bring up the devil right away. And it's like, well, there's actually no mention of the devil in the Bible. But if
right.
you're a Christian, then of course the snake is the devil. And so we have to work through these like kind of complex arguments that people have already constructed for themselves and tease them apart and get to the root of what the text says. And so why would this be useful to anyone? It's like, well, what else are you doing in meetings with business people? I mean, like, I've never worked in a big company, but I've been in meetings before. And if you can't articulate the problem well, then the meeting goes nowhere.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
People are just talking in circles. And so at St. John's, you get a lot of practice talking and, more importantly, listening. You know, there are 15 people around the table. You're not speaking, half that time. You're speaking 1/15th of that time if you know, the seminar is going well.
Right. Okay. So these are almost like greeting groups. And this is why I asked about the environment, is that don't picture listeners unfamiliar with St. John's like a giant lecture hall. Like, this is less than 1,000 people at this school, right?
Oh my gosh, less than 500, I think.
Oh, yeah. I love it. And I think because this program, even in like a trimmed down or sped up version of it that you did for the master's, it seems like in what I read about the undergraduate program, like literature is the largest component of it, like the most consistent component of it, you know, throughout, right? I think even in the article, it said like 4 years of literature, language, philosophy, and then it was like 3 years of laboratory science, 2 years of music in the undergrad program. So do you feel like, because I work with these guys. They have a show called Online Great Books, or Online Great Books podcast. Cool. And a lot of what they talk about on the podcast is not in the Western canon, but they talk about it the same way they would talk about the books. In their reading groups, because they also have this online, the seminars that they do, and people join and they participate in, you know, online seminars. It's a very, very cool thing. But
that's excellent.
Focusing on, you know, so much in literature and so much in philosophy, in these small groups, there's so much openness to interpretation that it does kind of force that practice in learning to learn and defending your ideas that might not be available in, you know, the harder sciences that obviously are important to a program like this. But I think having the program rooted in this kind of exercise is what makes people a little faster on their feet. Fair?
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah, you're spot on that. So I was just talking to a friend of mine who did the undergraduate program, and she's now in a master's program at Columbia on, I think, history and literature.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really worried about going because at St. John's, you don't get a lot of practice writing, let's say, research papers and looking at secondary sources. We're always looking at primary sources and writing directly about the text.
Right.
So she was a little worried if she would be prepared. And she said, what was most surprising to her, pleasantly surprising to her, is that she was the least afraid in her program to read something outside of her expertise. She just she knows how to read something for the content to tease apart what is and is not important. And you're right. St. John's students become very quick on their feet because they have 4 years of practicing talking, basically. And that sounds dull. That sounds not so important. But if you contrast that with students who are studying the sciences in this country and probably everywhere in the world, you're sitting in a huge lecture hall and being talked at all day. And then you go home and you do problem sets, which are you just like writing math on a piece of paper, and you totally lose your vocabulary. I have so many friends who have told me that since high school, they have lost their ability to speak. They've become less articulate.
Yeah.
Since high school.
Yeah. Yeah. Pause, even though I'm going to put this in the show. You are attending our encore of the summit, right? And thank you. And thank you very much for doing that. Scott Hambrick is one of the presenters. And he does the how to read a book thing, which will be certainly lots of review for you. But he was generous enough to come back and do a Q&A last time. I am going to see if I can get him to come back and do a Q&A, which could, because we have what's looking like it's going to be a small group, you guys could actually like dig into this stuff together. And I think that would be really fun to participate in and even just to listen to. So I'll see if I can.
Awesome.
I'm going to see if I can get both the guys who do the Online Great Books podcast. I recently worked with them. We did a couple of shows on Marshall McLuhan, who's certainly not, you know, in the Western canon, but we talk about one of his books. So let's see if we can make that happen. I'm excited about that. I will get to work on that.
Awesome.
So we could talk about St. John's, I'm sure, for a long time, but let's move on to Yale, right? And you get into this PhD program that you leave, and I wanted to hear a little bit about that story and why you decided to not continue that.
Yeah. Leaving a PhD program from Yale takes a lot of reflection, or maybe you would say it's really risky, but I think I thought about it for over a year, maybe since the day I got there. I ultimately decided to leave because I was working towards a degree that I knew I wasn't going to use, at least in the sense, like, I didn't want to be a chemist. Maybe I could have used the three letters, but then I could have gotten the three letters in anything and maybe in something I cared about a little bit more.
Right.
And my loans were in deferment, so that was great. And I was making a little bit of money, but I eventually just thought the cost benefit analysis was not in my favor. I was going to graduate around the time I was 30. I was like, is this really when I want to start my career when I'm 30, or do I want to, you know, give myself at least a few years before that?
Yeah, sure.
So I had a unique experience where I had the best advisor in the whole world. And so many people told me I should stay just for that reason, because it's so hard to find a good advisor in academia. But I couldn't. I couldn't justify it to myself. I couldn't look myself in the mirror and say, if you spend three more years here, it will be worth it. And you will look at your kids and tell them how great it was that you spent, you know, what is it, 8 years of your life after undergrad doing more school.
Sure. Can I ask a question? Why is it, as you just expressed, such common knowledge that it's very hard to find a good advisor? That's a little scary.
Yeah. So that's a good question. How should I answer it? I think this comes from a few places. Number one, in the sciences, you're a workhorse, right? So you're in the lab all the time. You're trying to get results, and then you're trying to write up those results and publish them under your name. And the more you publish, the more your advisor looks good. And so some advisors really work their students to an unhealthy degree,
yeah.
Especially for how much they're getting paid and how unlikely it is that those grad students become professors. It just doesn't seem like a good environment for that reason. And then in the humanities, my understanding is you're basically all on your own. Your advisor isn't so invested in the work that you're doing because you don't publish under their name. You just kind of publish on your own. And if you're lucky, you have an advisor who helps you, helps further your career. But otherwise, it's just someone you go to talk to every once in a while.
Okay. So I'm not trying to confirm my own biases here. So certainly tell me if I'm wrong. Have you ever heard of a book by a physicist? It's called Disciplined Minds. It's by Jeff Schmidt.
And, no, I haven't. Okay. Tell me about
it. So he writes about, and I was actually, a few years ago, I was in a relationship with a woman who was going through nursing school, and I just saw like the stress and what I would sum up as the transfer of punishment from like the instructional level to the student level. And, you know, Jeff Schmidt, I don't want to say that this book really has like a conspiratorial tone, but it talks about the, you know, graduate school in sciences, in medicine is very much like a conformity finishing school, right? And you have a lot of smart people who certainly have the brain power to do a lot of independent thinking. And they also, you know, this brain power is needed to keep these systems going. And a certain level of conformity is required. And the model that I don't think is intentionally set up, but it sort of becomes like the natural way that a lot of things, a lot of these programs wind up working, is that there is a transfer of this, maybe instructors saying, well, this sucked for me, it's going to suck for you. And you know, that just gets passed along to the next generation of students. Like, I had somebody who made this really hard for me, who punished me in these ways. This is the way that it is. I'm going to make sure you feel the pain that I felt. And maybe it's never that explicit in the way I just stated it, but that that culture kind of exists in these places.
I think you're right. I don't think it's that explicit. I definitely think students feel that way. Or another thing that happens is students go into PhD programs thinking, oh, I'll be a professor. Mm-hmm. And the likelihood of that is so slim. And so they spend 2 years coming to realize that. And then they have 3 years left. And yeah. they're like, okay, I got to stick it out. But I now know that this is not my path. And so they don't want to give it 120%. they want to start, you know, exploring the rest of the university that they've been completely shut out from the past 2 years. And that's when I think advisors start asking questions like, why aren't you here as much? Or you haven't delivered on, you know, the paper that you said you were going to write. And students become resentful. I think they can't wait to get out, and but are also like, I don't even know what I want to do. So I need my advisor to help me get to where I want to go, even though I don't know where that is. And it's a bad cycle.
Yeah. I just want to admit, you probably know this from listening to the show recently, I'm way out of my depth here. I you know, was in a master's program for maybe like a year and a half when I was 25, and got up one day during a break and grabbed my stuff and went to the parking lot and got in my car and left and submitted a letter a couple days later saying I was withdrawing. So that's my grad school experience. So
I mean, that's basically what I did. Passed my qualifying exam last March.
Yeah.
And then basically respectfully declined to keep going. I don't even think I've told Yale officially yet. I've told my advisor, obviously, because I'm not there right now. But I get letters or emails from Yale all the time, like, you haven't submitted your report. So I think we have a similar story.
In the very broadest of strokes, sure. Yeah. What was your total time commitment to that program?
I was there for 2 years.
2 years. Yeah. And you said it was like two or three left?
At least, yeah.
Yeah. So then, silver lining here, let's talk about what you do now.
Yeah. So now I'm an independent educator. And I've been doing this since I started grad school.
I figured, yeah. Yeah.
2015. I've been tutoring students, you know, in my own time. I love high schoolers. I think they're really fun. I think they're still imaginative and curious, like elementary and middle schoolers, but they have a new wit to them. So they're really fun to hang out with. And I am working. So in addition to tutoring students, I am working for this awesome education program called PolyGens that lets kids learn whatever they want to learn. And they're teamed up with an expert mentor to help them do that. And at the end of their like PolyGens experience, they produce a project that they can share with their friends and families or community, whoever, you know, they want to reach. And I'm so excited about what they're doing because I think they're finally giving kids the opportunity to ask themselves, what do I care about? And right now we reserve that question until college. And that's why kids change their major 3 or 4 times and flush tons of money down the drain.
Yeah.
But now they get to ask the question early and take their answer for a test drive.
Yeah. Yeah. And do something with it.
Yeah,
right. That's awesome. So let's actually, I want to talk about how you got involved there. But another topic related to your independent work, there's a lot of people who listen to this show who are young and who I think have a very healthy and well-developed attitude towards education, especially education versus schooling, that have credentials and could be doing this work and might have the time to do this work. So how did you get that door open to just like acquiring the first clients for tutoring?
Yeah, I started by just posting an online profile on a site called wyzant.com, WYZANT.com. And this is an online marketplace for students in anything to find tutors. So I even use Wyzant myself. I was trying to learn Adobe Illustrator and I couldn't figure out how to do something by just Googling it.
Amen.
So I found a tutor who teaches Adobe and they helped me out. So that's how I got my foot in the door. And then these students can post reviews about you. They can, you know, give you 1 to 5 stars. And then your students end up doing a lot of advocacy for you. I have students who just tell their friends about me and they're like, hey, I found this great tutor. I know you're struggling in this class too. Here's her number. And it's been great.
Yeah, it's really how that business has to work. I mean, word of mouth. It's nice. Like when I was doing it, these platforms or these marketplaces didn't really exist. So, I mean, that would have, I think, propelled it a little bit further where people can go and you're I mean, you're competing with a lot of people who are doing the same thing. And that was a challenge when I was doing it, is we were just competing with bigger companies who would go in and say, hey, we'll make a, I mean, you know, we were doing primarily SAT and college consulting services. But as far as the SAT or the ACT or the SAT 2 subject tests were concerned, companies, and this was, you know, the greater Boston area where I was doing this work, companies would go in and say, we'll make a deal with the school, $59 every kid, and you can't compete with that if they're a big company. So, you know, eventually there was just a lot of friction from so many different directions in keeping that work going. But when you start out and you are competing against other people and you don't have a lot of reviews, was that like a bit of a challenge?
You know, not as bad as I thought. So Wizant lets you set your rate. So my rate was really low in the beginning. And I got a few students from there. And I mean, it's an incremental process. I wasn't, you know, flooded with students in my first year of tutoring, but I've been doing this for 5 years now. And now it's not very hard to find students. And another thing that Wizant offers is online tutoring. They have an online platform. So there are students who log into Wizant and say, I need a tutor within an hour because I have something due and I don't understand it. Like, they just have tutors at the ready. So there's a huge market. So I think it's possible to penetrate, but you have to be persistent. You have to give it some time for sure.
And this wound up growing into basically your own business doing this.
Yeah. And so I have my own site, stacyhill.com, and you can book an hour session with me if you want. I love the freedom and flexibility that I have tutoring students and working for myself and deciding who I want to work with and what subjects I want to tutor. And I tutor a lot of subjects, and I do that on purpose. First of all, it means my day is more variable and more fun. But I think it's important for my students to know that I could help them with anything, and even things that I don't necessarily know about, because that shows them that they could learn it too. Like, if I can sit down and understand how to dissect a textbook, so could they. Yeah. And a lot of my tutoring is not me teaching them the material. It's like, okay, what are you confused about? And they don't know how to say it. So we like circle around a problem for a really long time. I'm like, okay, well, is there an example problem like this in your textbook? And then they have to open their textbook, which they've never done before. And they're like, oh my gosh, where do I go? And I teach them like what an index is and how they can find, you know, they're learning sine, cosine, tangent, where to find that page. And so it's a lot of teaching kids how to be autonomous. The thing I would hate is if a student came to me 3 years later and said, I can't learn anything without you. That would be horrific to me. So I really try to empower my students.
A right to make them independent of you, right? Your business model is to make yourself obsolete and have them pass that information along to somebody else who doesn't see someone like you as obsolete yet. Yeah, I absolutely love that. I love that. And where do you see that going next? Are you kind of happy with where you are right now? I mean, now that you don't have this Yale program weighing you down, or at least monopolizing your time, what's your ambition for this over the next year or two?
I really hope to be working more with PolyJones, just because I'm thrilled about their model of just letting kids learn whatever they want. Mm-hmm. Kids have so much more fun with it. They're really inspired. They become motivated. They start taking ownership over the things they want to do, and they start prioritizing their time. Like, just so many good things come out of that. So I want to be working more with PolyJones. And specifically right now, I'm trying to help them find students. I'm trying to understand the homeschooling community more, basically, because I think homeschoolers have a lot of time to learn whatever they want to learn and they haven't been crushed by school. They just have those homeschoolers I know have an imagination unparalleled with kids in school. And they also are very articulate and just know how to structure their time and apply themselves in a way that the kids I meet in school don't.
Absolutely. So that's actually where I was going next, just thinking about home education and unschooling for this. And this sounds like a perfect thing for a lot of these people. So let's just talk about PolyJones a little bit. Where did it come from, if you know, and how does like the enrollment and the execution process work?
Sure. Yeah. It was started by two grad students at Stanford University, actually. And I'm in the Bay Area right now, which is how I got connected with them.
Yeah.
And they started this because they just saw a need. They were like, we meet with students all the time who are always learning the exact same thing. This can't possibly be right. How can we give them the tools to learn whatever they want to learn? And so they're already in, the founders are already in this network of graduate students. And they said, thought to themselves, we could literally pair students with any one of these graduate mentors. So for instance, I'm going to be working with a student this summer who wants to learn about the neurochemistry of the brain. And I know chemistry, not a ton of neurochemistry, but together we're going to learn that. And he's going to develop a project. I think he wants to write a children's book about neurochemistry of the brain. My favorite example is of this boy who's obsessed with engines. He's in middle school and all he wants to learn about is engines. So we found an author who's published a few books on World War II engines, plane engines, and they're paired up together. This expert is teaching him, you know, as much as he can. And at the end of the program, I think this student decided he wanted to make an online museum of these engines and like put together what planes does he want to include in his museum, which ones are okay to not include, and what kind of story does he want to show as you walk through this online maze of planes. I don't know what.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
really excited.
So can I ask you a question about that, where this would be a concern, because a lot of people, even if they do embrace home education or like fully embrace totally self-directed unschooling, you know, approach, they still have a schooled mindset sometimes, right? Like, it's a very hard thing to let go of. Even I've been doing this show for a decade. I catch myself, you know, having these kind of schooled in thoughts all the time about my own learning, or when questions are sent my way about, you know, younger people and what they're doing. So a concern might emerge if somebody in middle school, which is considered to be a crucial time, right, for learning many important things, is hyper-focused on one thing. If that concern was brought to you, how would you explain the benefit of this deep self-directed passion that this boy has for this one thing?
My first response might be, by directing him somewhere else is not going to make him any less obsessed. Kids who are obsessed are really obsessed. Like,
right.
You know any kids like that? They are gung-ho on whatever they want to learn right now. And without polygens, I think what happens is kids just are on Wikipedia all day learning about, you know, whatever they want to learn. And that's not a bad thing in my mind. But I think what polygens encourages kids and kind of cultivates in students is not just learning about the thing, but producing something, making something from your knowledge and sharing it with other people, I think is the most crucial part of polygens. Because who cares how much knowledge you have? If you can't share that with someone, it's effectively useless.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this reminds me of the Dorothy Sayers Lost Tools of Learning, where like maybe, you know, I worked with kids who were younger and maybe they were just completely satisfied, like watching YouTube videos and then talking about something for an hour or drawing a picture. But as kids get to, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, there's like a real need to make their own meaning, to actually project something into the world based on this thing, right? To feel efficacious. And if they don't get that opportunity, it's like, it's a trick of this age, is like there's so much input, right? And if you can't translate it into some output, this is one of the things that I realized about, you know, doing the Ideas into Action Summit. It's a super frustrating feeling, even for me. Like, you know, sit around here and I feel like I'm creating content. I feel like I'm putting stuff out into the world. But there have been times like in the recent past where I was like, God, the ratio of my, you know, input to output is way too high. I'm taking in so many things that I'm never going to make useful for myself or anybody else. And that's a hard thing. That creates frustration. It creates a lack of ease, for sure. So I, at least when I feel that way, I at least go, oh, all right, well, there's a way to change this and I can do this, this, and this. But if somebody's stuck in school or if they don't have the resources to actually do those things, I think that could be crushing for a lot of these kids.
Totally. And I mean, if you think about the work that kids get to produce in school, they're all producing the same thing. So yeah. Like, why would that give you any meaning? Why would that make you want to do your work if you're just going to learn what everyone else is going to learn? But I think if you have the opportunity to learn something new and produce something that you can share with your community and say, and teach someone else. I think when you teach someone else, I mean, what you do on this podcast is so enlivening and people feel your energy. They become interested in what you're interested in. You gain friendships that way because you're like, oh, this is, you know, the expertise of my friend. He is obsessed with this thing. I think schools are kind of limiting that ability. It makes kids feel like they're just the same as everyone else when they're not doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We were talking about the St. John's program. It's like the was the title of the article. Everyone, the most forward thinking institution teaches everybody the same thing. Right. But so many of the inputs are the same, but the outputs are infinite. The outputs are infinite. And, you know, I think about being a teacher and understanding how much I hated the conformity of output in school. But there's no other way as far as efficiency is concerned. To like you could say, all right, everybody write a book report on, you know, whatever book you want. But then it's like, as if, you know, I have to do grades, what do I have to read all these books? I guess there's criteria for evaluating a well-written book report, whether you've read the book or not. But you're stressed as a teacher and you're looking to streamline everything as much as you can. I had a conversation with that Honest Teacher Facebook personality recently. And I said, you know, I hate to admit it, but the kids you wind up liking the most in those really high stress environments are the kids you can ignore. And I hate that that's the case, but that was a true statement about my time as a teacher. So yeah, just the nature of the system is like all the inputs are the same, all the outputs are the same, you know? Right. And yeah. I'm trying to, Stacey, I'm looking for a transition. We're having such a positive conversation. And I know we have to talk about something that's, well, it's very negative, but I think we could draw maybe some positivity out of it at the end. So this pointing this out is maybe an attempt to transition into a study that you shared with me that actually came from Yale about student attitudes, right?
Yeah. How students feel about school. How do they feel at school?
Yeah. So how did this come to your attention?
It honestly just popped in my inbox. Yale sends out, you know, studies that are going on campus all the time. And this one caught my attention because it was about school. Basically, researchers at Yale University surveyed over 20,000 high schoolers.
Yeah.
And this is all across America, rural, urban, suburban, private, public charter schools, and asked them, you know, how do you feel at school? And 75% of the responses were negative.
Right.
Like just an overwhelming majority of students feel tired, stressed, and bored. Those were the top three emotions kids reported. And I saw this and I was like, wow, school sucks. Brett's been right all along. And so yeah. I sent it to you.
Yeah. And we're talking about two separate studies, right, that were both done as part of the same project. The first was an online study, so it was easier to collect a lot more. It was like 21,000. People, right?
Yeah.
And the way it worked was almost like a survey setup where they're asked to rate on a scale of 1 to 100 how often they experienced, I think, a range of 10 emotions that would have been like happy, proud, joyful, lively, sad, mad, miserable, afraid, scared, stressed, and bored. And like you said, the most common response was tired. But yeah. I also saw in the write-up, almost 80% of students reported feeling stressed more than they would like, and bored. I think it was like, and bored came in at like 70% of students indicated some level of boredom.
Yeah, I think it's actually students report feeling stressed 70% of the time.
Oh, okay.
At school, and or did I get that right? Yeah, they're bored 70% of the time and stressed 80% of the time. And the standard deviations on these numbers indicate that even the least stressed and bored kids are stressed and bored more than half the school day.
Yeah.
Which is just like unbelievable. So if you add up all these hours, if you just consider the 75% of time that say kids are stressed and bored of 7 hours a week, or sorry, 7 hours a day, 180 days a year. That's 1,000 hours a year of these emotions of just like being talked at, being bored, being stressed about the fact that you have a test on Friday. And if you don't do well, you're going to be benched from the soccer team. And that's the only thing in life that gives you meaning. It's just like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, this is terrible.
Absolutely. And I think we'll get more into that before we wrap up here. The second study was more of a qualitative of a much smaller group of people. I think they all came from Connecticut, right? And It was like just under 500 people. And it used experience sampling method. Are you familiar with the...
I'm not that familiar with it. But what I understand is basically the two studies compare and contrast. How do students report feeling about school when they're not in school versus in the moment? So the second study kind of pinged students on their phone or something.
How do you feel right now?
Exactly. And so they could say, students say they feel bored 70% of the time, but how bored are they actually?
Right.
And so the researchers spin a positive light on this second study. They're like, okay, well, actually, they're not bored as often as they say they are. But I think their spin on it is a little misleading because it, in my mind, it actually doesn't matter how often they're bored in school. It matters how they remember school because that's how they think of themselves the rest of their life. And so the narrative they tell themselves about school, so the retrospective analysis, I think is way more crucial to the, like, to the human beings we're raising than how they're actually experiencing school.
Or then percentages, right? Like I've always said on this show, it's the associations made, not just with self, which is huge, but also with learning, right?
Totally.
If boredom is the most common thing emergent from this, as far as, you know, student attitudes are concerned. The second study, the smaller study, the under 500 people study was... my reading of it was a sort of qualitative reinforcement of a much, much, much larger quantitative study.
That's
right?
How I understood it.
It's also called, I think, like the diary method, where you said students are just pinged. And I don't know if it's set up at certain increments of time, if you check in from certain environments. But basically, you know, you're just like this time and regularly over. Do you know how long that study went on for?
The second one?
Yeah.
I think it was just 2 weeks.
Okay. I mean, that's still pretty significant. And, you know, student gets whether it's a journal or a ping on the phone, like you said, record your thoughts, feelings, behaviors, what's the environment you're in. And then, you know, they draw out of all that information of the 500 students.
Yeah.
So when you talk about a spin being put on it, I think they try to maybe minimize the boredom a little bit by saying that there's this interrelation between negative feelings, right? Like it might just be tiredness, which is a whole separate problem, right? But people who are tired, if they're low energy, they're going to feel bored. So it kind of mushes everything together a little bit. Was that your reading?
Yeah. And I think there's so much about this study that bothers me, not just the results, but the spin, and also that, like, no one seems to know about this study. Like, this should be the most talked about thing in America, I think.
Well, it's just published, right?
It was published in January. And since then, the New York Times came out with this huge, like, expose that history textbooks are biased. It's like, duh, everyone's known that, like, for a really long time.
Yeah.
Like, this could totally be something that is all over the news, all over even Twitter. And I haven't seen it many places. I don't know why. I don't know if the researchers realize how important this is beyond like academic circles. But to answer your question about spin, I just got the sense that they were like, okay, here are the top three emotions, but maybe it's not as bad as we think given this in-person assessment.
Yeah. The sweeping under the carpet, it's not exactly that, right? If 1,000 kids were caught behind the football stadium bleachers smoking pot, it would be a news event, right?
Totally.
But when you actually talk, like, I think it was the American Academy of Pediatrics has, and many others. I mean, there's a lot. Even though it's not making national news, there has been a lot of discussion in recent years about the school start time.
Yes, yeah, and that's right. Mentioned in this article.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when sleep deprivation is an issue, I will agree with them that it can have obviously numerous negative health outcomes for people in this age group. People who are stressed gain weight. People who are, I mean, there's a super strong correlation with depression. There's correlation between stress and depression and drug use, right?
Yes. So, and alcoholism, yes.
Absolutely. And then riskier behavior, which, you know, teens have, teens are prone to riskier, you know, limit testing behavior anyway.
Yes. And they now have the suicide rate among young people has gone up astronomically. I was reading recently that it's now more likely for your teen to commit suicide than be murdered, which means your kid is more a threat to him or herself than a stranger on the street, which is terrifying. It's like, why is that okay? Why are we letting this happen? And no, school is not the culprit, the only culprit, but they're definitely not helping students get out of this rut. They're, if anything, enabling it.
So some positive trends might be some schools. I think I saw they were on the West Coast have actually started to experiment with later start times, which has been a recommendation, you know, like I said, by the American Academy of Pediatrics and many others for a while, right?
Yeah. So. I think that's true. So later start times. There are also, there's a company called, I think it's called Challenge Success, that is working. It basically, they go into schools and they survey the kids. They try and figure out how stressed they are and how motivated they are. And they work with the school to kind of reprogram the culture so that kids are having a better time and having a, you know, a more positive experience.
Mm-hmm.
So there are definitely efforts to minimize these negative emotions that kids are feeling. But I think it's astounding that even in private schools, this is, you know, they control for the experimentalists control for this is just in public schools versus private schools. And there's really no difference. It's kids everywhere feel this way.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that would be a shocking national news story, right? We talk about, like, if there was the 1,000 kids behind the football stadium smoking pot, it's a news event because it's like kids in danger, kids at risk, right? But a system that puts millions of these kids, you know, into these same risks is just ignored essentially for convenience. And the news story could be, in a rational world, excuse me for being utopian here, but like, people who are in charge of your children's education have an alarming lack of understanding about cause and effect. Look into it, you know. this might be of concern to parents. Like, tired is a physical experience, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is something that is easily, like, measurable and quantifiable. I, like, look at what time school starts, compare that to what a typical sleep cycle is for a teenager, how much sleep they need, what time they're forced to get up. Because it's not just like what time school starts. Like, I had to get up at least an hour before that. Yeah. And all anyone talked about in, like, high school homeroom, the only topic of conversation, 180 days, even though I was certainly probably not there all 180 days, was how tired we all were. So sleep deprivation is, like I was saying, a physical experience. But in the container of that physical experience, you have such an array of negative emotional experiences, right? And I think they talk about that in the article as well, right? Boredom is more of an emotional state, but certainly is the result of being low energy.
Yeah, and I mean, what I read about boredom is scientists think it comes from being in a situation that is meaningless to you. So when I think of this concoction of emotions, I think of standing in line at the DMV, having stayed on up all night with, like, a screaming baby with a deadline at work in 3 hours. Like, that is the concoction we're putting kids into. It's just like, this is a meaningless experience. You just, like, have to stand there. You're totally confined. You can't choose how to redirect your attention because that would be disruptive or maybe disrespectful. And then you're already exhausted, so you're not going to be engaged, you're not going to be motivated, but yet you're told you have to perform well by the end of the week or else.
Yeah.
It's like, what person would stay in that job? Like if you, you know, got hired for your next position, they were like, this is the expectation. You will sit in your seat. You will do what you were told. You are, you have to stay up all night to finish this assignment. And if you don't perform well, you'll get fired. You'd be like, I'm just going to quit.
Yeah.
I'm just going to quit. And you know what? This might have made sense. I think you talk about the history and you know it way better than I do. This might have made sense when we were, the majority of our workforce was factory labor. But yeah. 70% of our workforce now is service industry, service jobs.
Well, I would say made sense as far as like if the concern is like human flourishing and human happiness, school never made sense. Right.
1,000%. Yeah. If you're trying to train workers, let's say it's a utilitarian, operation. Sure. You're developing factory workers. But now we have a service industry. So even if you're considering this from a utilitarian standpoint, what you want is someone on the phone who can get your problem solved, who can take ownership, who can take action, who doesn't have to ask their boss's boss for permission to help you. You want people who are resourceful, and schools don't teach that.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there anything else that really stood out to you here that was troubling either about the findings or the spin that was put on them?
What I wish the article did that I know they wouldn't do is kind of project what this means for society. That's not what scientists write about. But if someone were to pick up this as a story, I think it's really important to connect this to what this means for people, 10, 20, 30 years down the line. And if you're putting kids in meaningless situations day in and day out and making them feel stressed day in and day out and making them feel like this concoction is the norm, like, I think we can trace this back to some really devastating habits and trends in America. And of course, school is not the only reason for those, but I think we need to think critically about how school perpetuates some of these things like alcoholism, depression, suicide, and just like mental health in general. Like all the universities these days have to have robust mental health centers because kids just can't cope with their anxiety. And part of the reason I think is because they're told they have to, perform well, and at the expense of maybe working out or just like having a good conversation with your parents at dinner or, other healthy habits, that in the past were more available to kids and more common in America.
I'm sure you're probably somewhat familiar at least with the Kaiser Permanente work on adverse childhood experience scores.
Not that familiar.
Okay, so
tell me about
adverse childhood experiences is a score, and I think Kaiser Permanente really like headed up a lot of this research and started making correlations between higher ACEs scores. And a higher ACE score would be determined by more traumatic events in childhood. Most of them are actually related to things that occur inside the family system, right? So they were able to find all of these correlations between like physical and, obviously we understand this would lead to emotional problems well into adulthood, but also physical problems as well. Just as a result of, increased levels of stress, anxiety, hypervigilance, those kinds of things. I would really love it if somebody, and that is a bold project, right? To put that out there and say, hey, what goes on in your family? This is like one of the things that, people have only recently become comfortable talking about or like as a topic of public discourse. These things that you might suffer in the privacy of your own home are going to have long-term like negative health outcomes for people. Turning up the volume on that, I think, in this culture is a very bold move. I wish somebody would be bold enough to do it for school, right? To create a sort of adverse school experiences criteria. I can't do it. I don't have the credentials to do that, but I'm throwing that out there. I think
it's
that would be
a great idea.
Yeah, I think it would be a really, really valuable, thing for the media to spin eventually. But there would be, at least some people who I think would like a more quantitative study like that on outcomes of school, because almost you know, so many of the really memorable, unfortunate, scary, frustrating, like those experiences were almost all in school for me, you know,
in
one way or another, or related to school.
Yeah. And I think one of the saddest things I think results from school is because we are assessed all the time, you are told constantly whether or not someone else thinks you're smart. And I think we just have a society that is so intellectually insecure. And that leads to things like people thinking they're not experts, that they can't do something, that they're not capable of, you know, providing the next great product or the next great study because they've been told their whole lives that they're not smart, or even just evaluating the news. Like, my parents didn't go to college, and I hear them say all the time things like, well, that's what the smart people know, or maybe you know this more than I do because you have, you know, all your degrees. And it's like, that's not true. Like, we're all human beings. We can all learn. And I know this firsthand as a tutor, like the kids who are told you have ADHD, you think slower, they feel stupid. And that is, like, I think one of the worst consequences. It's not mentioned in this study, but it's the thing I worry about the most, is that we're just raising a bunch of kids who feel dumb.
Yeah.
And that's devastating.
With the same need, once they become adults, to make meaning out of all that surrounds them. I became an adult. Like, I was 21 years old in 1998. Is that true? Yeah. Okay. So I entered a world where there was far less of just a cacophony of information mixed up with opinion and nonsense than there is today. It seemed manageable, right? I can't imagine becoming an adult in this world today with all of this. Again, it's back to input-output, right? All of this noise comes at people. The signal is low. The skills for pulling the signal out of that noise are underdeveloped, not just by K through 12 schooling, but by, you know, all the undergraduate programs that people are taught, this is what you need to, like, function in the real world. They add nothing to it. Like that article that you link on your website, you know, states.
Yeah, exactly. Like, St. John's is maybe the one exception. And yeah, but you're totally right.
So they still have this need to at least feel like they've obtained the signal from all that noise. So they go to people who claim that they've obtained the signal through the noise, or that they are the signal. And they get a kind of social reinforcement and support for not thinking for themselves. And we see these echo chambers with, you know, walls that get 20 feet higher every week. You know, it seems like for every sort of divisive event that happens in our culture, I don't see anything happening in our country that could produce a unification like people felt, say, after 9/11. I don't think a day like that is ever coming back, right? And I think that is, at least what's partially responsible for that, is the autopilot approach to this information acquisition, where people know they want to feel like they're capable of understanding what's going on, but deep down they don't feel like that. They've been schooled to believe that their whole lives. And now the reinforcements for that schooling come in these people who say, come with me, don't think for yourself, this is the way it is. And it affects all different, you know, political, ideological, philosophical stripes that people might be.
Yeah, my favorite metaphor of that comes from a Powderina book. And it's in the first chapter. He gives this metaphor of people listening to the news and kind of recording on their personal cassette tape what they will say to people after. So you just, like, you get the input and you spit it right back. And because of that, your thoughts are no different from anyone else. And not only is that, like, just, like, sad from that, like, people are not thinking for themselves, but I think the implication of this is that you are disposable, you're expendable, because you're just thinking like everyone else. If you're not contributing something different, if you're not asking even a question, then you're contributing to a narrative that's already been said over and over again. So what's your value? And, like, no one wants to feel that way. And yet that's what we've been doing to ourselves.
Yeah, your actions in the worlds of ideas are basically making, like, B.F. Skinner's arguments for him, right? It's like, oh, look, when this pigeon is hungry, it pushes this button. It's that simple. There's no inner life. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else to consider. And I'm not saying that in any way to be mean or derisive of people. I understand this. I'm sure there's areas of my life where I'm still susceptible to this. You know,
oh,
more
I'm
than,
totally
yeah.
susceptible to it. It takes so much work. It takes so much effort.
Yeah.
But if you surround yourself with people who are also questioning and thinking and who have different opinions than you do, then you become more interesting and your ideas become more nuanced. And you at least, before you speak, you might think about, oh, well, how would my friend over here think about that?
Yeah.
Anyway, this is a tangent, but I think it's important that kids get this sense of that they're stupid in school. And that's the last thing we should be teaching people. Maybe humility, but not stupidity.
Sure, absolutely. You can see maybe there's this picture behind me. It might be obscured by a tripod, but
yeah.
And it's too far away, so I'm going to have to explain what it is anyway. One of the it's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who's in Austria, and he was at the Viktor Frankl Museum. And there's this great quote attributed to Viktor Frankl that unfortunately he never said. I think the misattribution came from this author named Stephen Covey. But it's just like anytime this idea is mentioned, I think of Viktor Frankl. And it's just interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine who was in the museum yesterday and sending me pictures of quotes from it. This idea that between stimulus and response, there is a space, right? And in that space is our ability to choose our response. And in that ability is our freedom, right? And that is the thing that school and the reinforcements for school in the form of media, I think, are stealing from too many people. And one of the things that we have tried to reinforce on this show for years is that idea. Remember that space. If you don't feel your space is wide enough, and you know, whether it's an intellectual pursuit or an emotional concern, just always be working to widen that space.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that any better. This was so fun, Brett. Thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure.
And I just need to thank you for something more than that. What you do is so important. And every time I tune in, and as you know, it hasn't been that long, every time I tune into your show, every time I log on to your website, I learn a lot. And I share that with other people that I know. And I have great conversations because of it. So you're doing like the ripple effects that you have are real. And you should know that. And I really want to thank you for that.
I really, really appreciate that. And I hope you'll, you know, continue to do those investigations. I hope you'll find things that you disagree with, things that you think are wrong. I would appreciate that too. Or things that you have questions about. I'm looking for tolerable critics, right? The overlap, like in the Venn diagram between critical and intolerable, it's just almost one circle. Right. And that's and I don't think that's subjective. I don't think that's me. I think that if people are going out on the online to hate, right, that it's not coming from a healthy place. So I've had a hard time finding people. I thought there were critics who had valuable things to share, but they weren't enjoyable to talk to like you are. Mm-hmm. So you've got a lot of experience. You're extremely smart. Is you continue to sort of navigate the School Sucks project and you see things that are like, hey, what's this? Come on. Please let me know. You know,
okay.
Because
we'll
I've
have another show about it.
I started this show in 2009 and I extended beyond my areas of expertise probably by 2011. Right. So I've always had to be calling in experts, people who know more than me. And most of this project has just been like, hey, want to watch me work on my ignorance in public? You know, and that's a lot of what I've done with the show. So
well, I think it's a good model.
Yeah. And I'm always looking for people to participate in that conversation. And I really enjoyed this one. So we got to do it again.
Cool. I would love that.
Can you give your website one more time?
Sure. It's stacyhill.com. Or if you're interested in polygens, polygens.org.
Awesome. And Stacy with an I, just like in the title, everybody, of the show. So, all right, Stacy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brett.
Soon time will come.